Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
As you know, this is a session on sex education in erotophobia, and we have Terrence L. Day, who is a journalist, a research writer at Washington State University, who will present the paper. And the comments will be made by Victor B. Klein, professor of psychology at the University of Utah, president of the Marriage and Family Enrichment Incorporated. The way that this session will work is we will hear first from Mr. Day, and then the comments from Dr. Klein. And then there will be about 10 or 15 minutes for questions from the audience. So we'll proceed now with Mr. Day.
If I may conduct a very brief poll, I'm wondering how many of you have heard of A Parent's Guide, published by the Corporation of the First Presidency? Okay, thank you. This is the basis on which my paper is written. In 1985, the Corporation of the President of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints published A Parent's Guide, the Church's first sex education manual. This paper examines the manual in the context of sex-negative ethic of moral dualism. The manual's use of words and phrases for sexuality and sexual acts and the adjectives and adverbs used in conjunction with them are examined for their positive, neutral, or negative connotation. The publication advances some of the most positive public statements yet made by the Church regarding human sexuality. Yet its language reflects a powerful erotophobia, a fear of sexuality that overrides the positive statements. Questions of sexual ethics have always seemed perplexing, especially for religious people and for religious institutions. Each generation believes that it discovered sex, and in a manner of speaking, each does. Today, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its people are struggling with sexual questions perhaps as never before. Church leaders have long emphasized the primary importance of sexual purity, and they continue to feel a grave responsibility to preach the law of chastity. For this clear, unfaltering voice, the body of the Church can be grateful. Yet too often, injunctions to chastity have been burdened by negative connotations and forebodings about the dark side of sex that risk instilling in Latter-day Saints an inordinate fear of sex, or erotophobia as psychiatrists know it. Many LDS couples thus approach the nuptial bed not only with a divinely sanctioned physical desire for each other, but with profound misgivings about the expressions of physical love. Few of us in Western societies escape the influence of erotophobia, which can impose needless guilt, undermine self-esteem, and even impair spiritual development. Unwarranted guilt also jeopardizes wholesome sexual adjustment in marriage. Sexual maladjustment deprives both spouses of a measure of the loving nurture of sexual fulfillment. This may be particularly true for women. In both sexes, diminished sexual desire is the most commonly reported sexual maladjustment, and sex-negative feelings are a major contributor to this type of maladjustment. Consequent family stresses undoubtedly contribute to spouse and child abuse and to divorce. For these reasons, it is important to recognize erotophobia and to reduce its impact on our lives. Research that I've been conducting for 7 or 8 years now on the origins and the evolution of Christian sexual ethics provides compelling evidence that many of the sexual attitudes that influence Latter-day Saints do not arise, as we have supposed, from the gospel, but from pagan philosophies that predate Christianity. They come neither from the scriptures nor from revelation, but have been traced by scholars to at least Pythagorean moral dualism. Pythagoras, who lived in the 6th century BC, taught that male is good and female is bad, that the body is evil, and that sexual activities pander to demeaning passions. This philosophy comes to us in an unbroken chain through the great philosophers Plato and Aristotle. Philo played a major role in melding moral dualism and Christianity. Clement of Alexandria, St. Augustine, and St. Thomas also played vital roles in formulating or in defining Christian sexual attitudes. It's interesting to note, as we examine the Mormon Church's first sex education guide, that Clement, who produced Christianity's first known text on sexual practices in married life, borrowed heavily from pagan philosophy. Clement associates sexual activity with evil and glorifies self-restraint for its own sake. Nearly 18 centuries later, the LDS Church's first sex education guide perpetuates some of this pagan erotophobia. It has been both fascinating and deeply saddening to trace the evolution of Christian sexual ethics from Aquinas in the 13th century to the current day. Few Americans suspect the profound and pervasive erotophobia that raged through Western civilization well into the 20th century. As we address questions of sexual ethics, it's significant to note that as recently as 100 years ago, our ancestors lived through a veritable siege of sexual horror, an era of rampant erotophobia during which circumcision was introduced to prevent masturbation, and when masturbators were sent to insane asylums. Early in this century, when many of our parents and grandparents were in their formative years, one could not speak publicly about sex, nor could one write of it. Doing so was not only impolite, it was illegal. Margaret Sanger was arrested 8 times between 1914 and 1917 on obscenity charges. Her crime? She lectured about birth control. Although we may not personally remember these times, we are influenced by them, and perhaps especially so in our patriarchal Mormon culture. Whatever level of erotophobia Latter-day Saints may have experienced in the past, it has likely elevated in recent years as the church formally interjected itself into the bedroom to an unprecedented degree. Amid growing and alarming reports of child, spousal, and sexual abuse, a series of important but little-known events began in 1981 when the Church Social Services Department sent a book on human sexuality to local church leaders for use in counseling members. This book, Human Intimacy, Illusion, and Reality, was written by Victor L. Brown, Jr. of Citrus Heights, California. As we shall see later, Brown, or at least his book, evidently had great influence on a parent's guide. Next, the First Presidency issued the first of 2 communications on Temple Recommend interviews that I have dubbed the Bedroom Letters. On January 5, 1982, stake presidents and bishops were advised to ensure that candidates for Temple Recommends refrained from oral sex, which it interpreted as unnatural, impure, or unholy. Less than a year later, the First Presidency sent a letter cautioning local authorities not to pry into marital relationships. However, new Temple Recommend interview instructions contained a new question on refraining from unnatural, impure, or unholy practices. For the benefit of anyone who might ask for definitions of what constituted these practices, the First Presidency provided a 1-paragraph interpretation that was to be read verbatim to the questioner. It stated that the brethren had determined that both oral and anal sex were unnatural, impure, or unholy. Normal rules and procedures for repentance were to be applied. The latest development in this bedroom saga was removal of that question from the Temple Interview Book. This occurred about January 1986. It would appear then to cancel the Church's official concern with marital sexual practices. It was in this environment that the Church published a parent's guide in early 1985, either in conjunction with or coincident to admonitions to local priesthood leaders regarding child and spousal abuse, and announcing educational programs in these areas. The context of the guide's appearance is one permeated by negativism. It is important that we examine a parent's guide not only for the facts that it presents, but for the attitudes of its rhetoric reveals, because erotophobic tendencies have been correlated with conservative values, religious orientation, regular church attendance, and avoidance of sex as a topic of conversation, all descriptors that seem to define Latter-day Saints among other peoples. If you'll excuse me, it's getting awfully warm in here. I'm going to divest myself of this jacket. Any evaluation is, by definition, subjective and therefore risks controversy and criticism. Because of that danger and in the spirit of fair play, let me state briefly the background and values that I bring to this task. I'm a husband of one wife, father of six children, professional journalist, and an active high priest in the LDS Church, to which I hold a profound allegiance. I wholeheartedly and joyously embrace the law of chastity as God's divine law. In evaluating a parent's guide, I have relied primarily on an analysis of the value burdens of the author's words, but I also have examined other rhetorical tactics. All of this has been done within the perspective of my studies on the origins and evolution of Christian sexual ethics. I make no claim of unerring objectivity in assigning positive or negative values to words and phrases. Meritorious investigators may disagree on some interpretations. In every instance of uncertainty, I've tried to err on the side of grace to the authors. Words and phrases were divided into three lists: positive, negative, and neutral, depending on definition or connotation. Positive words and phrases are those that would be likely to give the reader a favorable impression of sex, that would convey the idea that sex is good and that it is proper and healthy to enjoy it. Negative words and phrases are those that would be likely to give the reader an unfavorable impression of sex, that would be likely to convey the attitude that sex is dangerous, wrong, evil, etc. Neutral words and phrases are those that are likely to convey neither negative or positive connotations. There is, let me read from my table on this a few examples of words in those categories. I don't have it stapled to this. You can ask later if you really want to know. And there is, in undertaking any study of this nature, one overbearing problem. It is that words have different meanings to different people. Connotation, which can be even more important than definition, is even more highly subjective and greatly influenced by context. For example, narrowly defined, the word sex is neutral, but it may bear a positive or a negative connotation depending largely on the values of the listener or the reader. It also may receive good or bad connotations depending on the company it keeps. in the company of such modifiers as abuse, carnal, defiled, devilish gratification, indecent, lust, it takes on a bad connotation. But modify it by such descriptors as clean, enjoyable, good, pleasurable, and virtuous, and the word sex takes on a good connotation. In clinical use, phrases or words such as questions about sex or sex characteristics, I have classified as neutral, unless some value burden is implied within the structure. I'm not aware of any way to deal in a study of this kind with questions of connotations that the reader himself or herself will bring to words. For the true erotophobe, sex always has a negative connotation, and so does any word associated with the subject, no matter how clinical or how positive a connotation others may place on it. At the other extreme, the erotophile may see good in almost every sexual association. Now for my findings. The language of a parent's guide is overwhelmingly negative, displaying a profound distrust of sexuality. I found 456 words and phrases referring to sex and sexuality. This does not include the word gender, which is used many times, nor does it include many uses of the word intimacy where the author's intention was not clear. In some cases, intimacy is clearly used in a non-sexual connotation in this manual. Therefore, it was not counted. Even the authors caution that when they use the phrase physical intimacy, they do not necessarily mean to imply a sexual relationship. In cases where the use of the word was clearly a sexual one, it was then put in the data. Only 64 references, or 14% of 456 references, convey a clearly positive image of sex. Clearly negative references accounted for 170, or 37% of the total. And 222, or 49% of the references, were neutral. A large number of neutral references came in sections on how to teach children up to the age of puberty. They deal fundamentally with biology and psychology. Whether one weighs positive statements against the sum of positive, negative, and neutral, or only against the sum of positive and negative, the guide falls far short of the sex-positive instruction needed by Latter-day Saints. But whatever its shortcomings, there is much to applaud, and loudly at that. For the guide contains some of the most positive affirmations of the holiness of human sexuality that have ever been publicly made by the Church. Indeed, the very best thing about the guide is that the Church has published it. The tone of a parent's guide is sex negative, but the manual puts the Church squarely on the record for the first time as officially endorsing non-procreative aspects of human sexuality. It would be difficult to exaggerate the importance of this pronouncement for the development of healthy attitudes about marital sex. The guide speaks of the sexual relationship in marriage as one that is uplifting. It talks of the feeling of joy of the physical senses. It speaks of righteous intimacy. The physical changes of puberty are described as clean, good, and divinely mandated. We're counseled to teach our children that their bodies are good, that in creating them, God declared that His creation was good and that they will find joy in their bodies when they use them virtuously. There is throughout the manual a positive tone about frank discussions of sex in the home, including the use of scientific terminology, such as penis and vagina. There is wise counsel that parents shouldn't overreact to their children's use of vulgar sexual terms. Use of reliable reference books is recommended as sources of sexual information. The guide quotes President Spencer Kimball as saying that the intimacy of sexual relations is right and divinely approved in the context of lawful marriage, and that God ordained sexual relations not just as a means of procreation, but as an expression of love established to bring joy. In urging parents to teach their children proper sexual attitudes, the manual cautions do not speak of their awakening sexual interest as sinful or unclean. We are told to teach our children that the deeply pleasing intimacies, will be built in marriage. Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, and Matthew 19, 5 and 6 are cited as evidence that sexual expression is ordained of God. Sexual congress is called this sacred act. Here is the manual's only use of the word passion in a positive sense. Here truly is cause for rejoicing. The most sex-positive chapter is on courtship and marriage. Exactly half of the 60 references to sex are positive, 45 are negative, and 5 are neutral. For all of this, the authors should be applauded. 49% of the total sexual references in the guide are used in a neutral connotation. Most of these references were used in a biological sense, describing human physiology without the burden of value judgments. Negative connotations were found in 37% of total sexual references and in 73% of the value-burdened references in the guide. Notwithstanding many positive statements, the authors introduced their subject on a strong note of negative imagery. 80% of the value-burdened references to sex in the introduction are sex-negative. There are 12 negative words and phrases, and only 3 positive ones. Negative words include lust, unrighteous dominion, adulterous acts. Positive references are such things as righteous meaning and the use of intimate physical relations, true intimacy, lawful relationships. Perhaps these positive examples illustrate the need for largesse in assigning positive value. For all 3 may connote negative values at the same time they convey positive associations. For example, lawful relationships suggests unlawful relationships, and therefore negative connotation. Similarly, proper actions suggest improper actions. However, the author's intent in such usages obviously is positive, and they were so credited. In setting the stage for discussion for the proper role of human sexuality plays in our lives, references to undesirable aspects of sexuality outnumber positive ones 3-1. This is chapter 1. Here, abuse, defile, degrade, lust, misuse, immorality, appetites, and physical gratification overpower righteous intimacy, joy, and uplift. In the section on principles for teaching children, chapter 2, negative words and phrases outnumber positive ones 16-1. Negative connotations outnumber positive references 4-1 in the chapter on adolescence. 46% of the references in this chapter are neutral. We understand that the author's intention is to foster chastity. It is LDS doctrine that adultery and fornication are second only to murder in seriousness as offenses against God. Unfortunately, this great caution against sexual sin exacts a heavy toll on the image of sex that our young people develop in these formative years and come back to haunt married couples in the form of unhealthy inhibitions and of unwarranted guilt feelings over their sex drives. Female breasts are used in a negative context, and sex drive, masturbation, mate, arousal, sexual feelings in sinful ways, purveyors of evil, carnal, perversion, selfish, abuse, shame, wicked, and lustful boys convey negative images. Parenthetically, we find no lustful girls in our manual. This could be either an innocent happenstance or a product of residual Victorian misconceptions. The chapter on courtship and marriage is the only chapter in which positive connotation approaches half of the valued words and phrases. Yet even here, more than half the images, 27 or 53% of the valued references, are negative. 24 or 47% are positive, and 3 are neutral. The section begins with two warnings, and then, after some unqualified positive statements, we return to negative values. Engaged couples must avoid talking about their coming sexual relationship and must not give undue attention to sexual information in their individual preparation, for it may actually create problems. They must avoid morbid desire and practice self-control. Honeymooners must avoid sexual excesses and any unnatural conduct. We are reminded from an early instruction in the manual that there is no such thing as a sex drive. We're admonished not to use our partners merely for the gratification of passion. Self-control is the crowning glory of true manhood, and we are warned that sexual indulgence whets the passion and creates morbid desire. At times, complete abstinence isn't ordered for married folk. Almost every positive statement about human sexuality is offset by warnings. At times, the authors extol pagan notions of self-control and abstinence, while curiously ignoring Paul's admonition in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that both husbands and wives have a right to sexual fulfillment and an obligation to sexually satisfy their partners. For the most part, the biological information offered by a parent's guide is sound, but in a few places the authors fail. We are misinformed about the human body and its functions in chapter 5, where we are told that the world makes divinely created bodies the object of carnal lust by making the female breasts primarily into sexual enticements, while the truth is that they were intended to nourish and comfort children. The authors conveniently ignore Solomon's song and Proverbs 5:19 that speak approvingly of breasts as sexual attractions for men and of women yearning for this form of attention from men. But the worst disinformation in the guide has to do with the author's attempt to refute the existence of the sex drive. The authors closely follow Brown's book, which dismisses the sex guide, or the sex drive, as another dogma of a carnal world. Rather, Brown reasons and this is a quote, alleged sex drive is actually an appetite learned from culture and reinforced by biology, its satisfaction institutionalized by culture. Brown notes that we can control when, where, how, and with whom we gratify our sexual urges, as if the ability to control the sex drive somehow blots out its biological imperative. Never mind that we also control when, where, how, and with whom we gratify our thirst and hunger, or that both society and the church direct many conventions at controlling these appetites. There is no significant argument in the scientific world that I am aware of over the existence of a sex drive, although there are arguments aplenty over its nature and the mechanisms involved. The guide also perpetuates the church's long-standing injunction against masturbation. Treatment of this important subject is uneven. In one section, parents are admonished not to overreact to genital self-exploration in young children. This, of course, is enlightened counsel. Parents who do so may cause great mischief for their children's later enjoyment of sex. Unfortunately, the advice is based on the misapprehension that small children don't masturbate, whereas systematic masturbation is common in children at 6 to 8 years of age, and masturbation to orgasm has been reported in children less than 1 year old. Yet elsewhere in the manual, masturbation is condemned for youth and adults. Surely it also would be condemned for children if it were defined as masturbation. The author's definition of masturbation leaves open not only the probability of confusion in discussing the topic, but also the possibility that some couples might understand the church to condemn much foreplay and afterplay between husbands and wives. This brings us to the rhetorical devices, to the literary mechanism whereby the authors have woven the language in our guide.
This is the end of side one.
In essence, it's the technique of warning, saying something good, another warning, and sometimes several warnings. An example of this kind of whipsaw treatment occurs in the chapter on marital sex, where we're told that one of the purposes of sexual intercourse is to bring joy to the participants. But on the next page, we run pell-mell into the assertion that the sex drive doesn't really exist, and we're advised that there are times within marriage when complete abstinence is appropriate for extended periods of time. The section on teenagers, the section begins with a disparaging remark about our so-called sex drive, promises remarkably heightened pleasures of touch and arousal, and then cautions that we must control these urgings, and it's followed by 14 paragraphs of almost unbroken litany of warnings and cautions laced with the most vivid sex-negative words imaginable: selfishness, perversion, immorality, carnality, masturbation, abuse, wickedness, and lustfulness abound. Conclusions. The evidence from both the analysis of word and phrase connotation and of rhetorical devices argues strongly for the thesis that the message of a parent's guide is erotophobic. Notwithstanding many positive statements about human sexuality, the reader is likely to come away from the manual suspicious of the propriety of sexual enjoyment, even in marriage. The guide's attempt to clothe LDS anti-masturbatory attitudes and policies in the garments of sociology and psychology invite both suspicion of erotophobic influence and ultimate rejection of the church's position. No scripture or revelation is cited for authority except for 1 Corinthians chapter 3, 16 and 17, and also Alma 41 and 10. Neither of which is used in a sexual context in Holy Writ. If the reasons for eschewing masturbation or any other sexual practice are medical or are founded in psychology or sociology, surely Latter-day Saints are at liberty to judge for themselves the merits of these arguments. The Church seems not to realize that its position on masturbation may, indeed undoubtedly does, contribute to the incidence of fornication and adultery. This subject is overripe for investigation and critical analysis. Are the Church's teachings on masturbation gospel or an erotophobic vestige of 19th century Victorianism? A parent's guide should be welcomed for the many positive statements that it makes in support of human sexuality. It is the Church's most positive statement yet on sex. The challenge for local leaders and for parents is to glean from it all of the many virtues that it offers in support of the enjoyment of sex in marriage, while winnowing out the chaff of pagan sex negativism. The challenge for the Church is to purge erotophobia from its educational materials and policies, and I'm reasonably optimistic that it eventually will. Mary Beth Raines, a licensed marriage and family therapist and a clinical social worker here in Salt Lake, has pointed the way in her call for a positive approach to sex education. She said, "You cannot teach a positive concept using only don't and never, and expect a person to have a positive understanding of that idea." And also, quote, in my view, translating all of our injunctions about sexuality and the moral code into positive phrasing and meaning will result in more willing obedience with fewer negative effects. It would seem that the church hasn't taken into account the emotional and spiritual costs of teaching chastity by sex-negative denunciations. Surely the burdens of this sex-negative approach warrant exploration of a more sex-positive stance. Thank you.
I very much appreciate this opportunity to comment on Terrence Day's presentation critiquing the church's first sex education manual, chastely titled A Parent's Guide. I just might mention a little bit about my bias and where I'm coming from. I'm a clinical psychologist. I do a lot of marriage counseling. I do quite a bit of treatment of sex offenders, of couples who are having problems in the area of sexuality, and my bias is very much pro-sex. I feel it's important that couples, this is an important part of a couple relationship, to have warm, bonded, affectionate sexual relations, and where there are blockages there and whatever, I work very tenderly with husbands and wives to accomplish more affection, physical affection, whatever, because I think that's an important part of the bonding process that occurs in a marriage relationship. And the better that is, the more I think it helps heal and help in other areas of marital relationship and conflicts. Now, by very strange happenstance, which I think the Sunstone people were not aware of, I was on the church committee that was first called to write this manual, which she is talking about, 4 or 5 years ago. And a group of us, mainly physicians, psychologists, social workers, and plus a few others, were gradually replaced on this committee as the manual went through revision after revision over a period of several years. The final product was nothing like the first draft, which we produced, or that I was acquainted with at the time I was released from the committee. Now, it was general knowledge among those of us who worked on the committee that the church authorities felt a very keen responsibility to produce a manual directed toward parents, which would help them teach the facts about human reproduction as well as sexual values to their children in ways that were harmonious with scientific facts as well as being consistent with the doctrines of the church regarding human sexuality. Now, very interestingly, a number of previous attempts had been made to handle this topic in an official church publication before we came on the scene, but none ever quite hit the bullseye or was felt acceptable or could pass muster. We also heard that in the quorum, nothing was passed on unless there was total unanimity among the brethren. If just even one member of the quorum had reservations about an issue, this was tabled for a while till unanimous consent was obtained. Now, while this may or may not be true in this particular manual, my sense is that on any sensitive subject such as this, where the church takes a fairly official stand, that the approach of the leadership will be to initially be cautious and conservative and certainly represent a reasonable consensus of church leadership. Now, while one may carp or complain about certain specifics in the manual, actually I, for one, was delighted that it got published after so many occasions before where they were not published, and then it got disseminated to the members of the church. I personally felt that it was long overdue. And I would guess that as new versions get introduced, they will be more in-depth, will correct whatever error or inaccuracies might be or exist in this manual. The most exciting thing which I note about the church, in my experience, is its willingness to grow, to change, to modify itself and its programs in ways that bless the saints. When I first moved into Utah some years ago, the church had a vast array of hospitals which it owned and administered, but it did relatively little to assist people with mental and emotional and family health problems. Now, some years later, the hospitals are gone, and there exists throughout the world of the church a vast network of professionals and LDS social services who minister to girls pregnant out of wedlock, who assist couples with marital problems, including sexual problems, who give professional assistance to a whole variety of emotional, mental difficulties that the saints may have, which require services beyond what a bishop might be able to do with his limited resources. Now, my experience with the church, this is just my own personal experience, and its leadership is that it is not afraid to change and to try out new programs or actually junk those that don't work. The church, in my observation, is very pragmatic and very much results-oriented. With regard to Terrence Day's presentation, I think there are many things that are good and right about it. I think his basic theme is to suggest that while the church comes down very hard on inappropriate sex and certainly has a lot of negative injunctions about that, it rarely mentions the positive aspects of sexuality in a bonded relationship in a loving marriage. Thus, what comes across is a message that may seem to imply that all sex is bad. And I don't think that anyone in the church really believes that. But by saying no, 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 in their many preachments, it may tend to produce inappropriate guilt in some Latter-day Saints who may, in fact, be essentially sinless in their sexual lives, thus producing unnecessary problems in their inner psychic sexual life and possibly in their marital relationships because they are supposedly made to feel so negative about their sexuality. Now, let me just share with you for a moment out of my clinical experience. I've been doing psychotherapy, working with couples with sexual problems, a great many of them, the majority probably in the LDS community. And I observed many trends for many years. And I'm going to just share with you what my experience is. Other therapists in the audience may have others. But I have yet to find, in 30 years, a single LDS male ever who felt continuously guilty about his sexual urges, desires, or about having sex relations with his wife when he was living the gospel sexual code. I've never yet met a male. In fact, I actually see it the other way, that there are a significant number of LDS males who transgress the sexual code and experience little or no guilt when they are doing things which are sometimes clearly illegal, even harmful to others, or in violation of marriage covenants. In other words, I don't see guilt as necessarily always bad. Guilt can be like a sensor or alarm that alerts us when we are doing things that may have major negative consequences later for us. However, and I hope you'll understand where I'm coming from, this is just my experience, with LDS women, it's a different ballgame. I've seen a large number of them, and I see many with diminished sexual desire. And I think that this can come from negative programming about their sexuality. Now, I'm not here to explain why it is that I'm finding this, but it is something that I have come across again and again. But usually I have found that it is a family affair. It has been taught to them by their parents or mother, who may also have negative feelings about sexuality, or by being abused by males, older brothers, fathers, male kinfolk, or having very bad experiences with males in early dating relationships. And so there's a turning off, in a sense, to their sexual nature, or to some degree. It's possible that some of it may have come from overkill in talks received from some youth leaders. But in all honesty, most of the talks that I've ever heard given to LDS youth groups may have actually been handled with great sensitivity and tact and do not represent inappropriate negative conditioning about human sexuality, only cautions about dealing with a vital life force. And I see nothing wrong with that. In fact, with all of us living in a world where sex is trashed daily on TV and movies and modern novels, where there are, in many cases, no standards taught, I think the church's very clear standards about sexual morality is refreshing and, for the most part, health and relationship promoting. Mr. Day's comment that the LDS Church's sex education guide perpetuates pagan erotophobia represents, in my judgment, a kind of overkill on his part, or maybe an overreaction. And I'm not sure that sexual conservatism can be honestly termed an entirely pagan practice. Actually, I would believe that it to be the other way around, with most sexual restraint advice as coming from many parts of both Old and New Testaments, with deity as the authority for this. And this is related to the importance of protecting the bonds of affection and attachment between husband and wife, thus stabilizing the family as a social institution. Let's take the issue of masturbation. The church counsels against it, yet any high school or college textbook on human reproduction will tell our kids that masturbation is great. Go at it. It's harmless. You won't go insane if you do it, or lose your virility, or in any way be harmed or injured. So it would look like the church is hopelessly unscientific, outdated, and just a bunch of old fogies trying to ruin our kids having a great good time. But I don't think it's that simple. Consider the following. The best evidence suggests that all sexual deviations are learned behavior, and it is males overwhelmingly who have them. I see no good evidence anywhere that sexual deviations are inherited. The evidence, I think, is overwhelming, suggesting that they are indeed learned. And even though the level of our sexual need or the libidinal strength that we may have is probably a genetic thing, modified somewhat by our personal health and maybe medications that we might be having, some of which can wipe out sex drive, I think for the most part, the level of sexual drive, if you want to call it that, or need or whatever, probably is genetic, but not what it's attached to. If sexual deviations, which I treat daily, are learned, then how are they learned? The correct answer is usually through accidental conditionings. McGuire, Carlisle, and Young, British researchers, suggest that it happens typically through a process of masturbatory conditioning. The male, by chance or accident, is exposed to something which triggers sexual arousal and excitement. He may masturbate as a way of getting relief from the sexual tension generated by the event. And it could occur while he is peeping, exhibiting himself, maybe accidentally, where others see him, being seduced by someone as a child, or seeing pornography, modeling inappropriate sexual activity, and on and on. Now, the problem is that there's a chemical called epinephrine, which research suggests facilitates at times of emotional or sexual arousal the locking in powerfully of the imagery that the person is exposed to in the mind. Now, these very vivid sexual images then return, being locked in there very powerfully, again and again to haunt and stimulate the young man. Every time he masturbates to the image, he then reinforces the linkage or the connection in his mind between the maybe illegal, inappropriate, or immoral act and his own attraction to that activity. Thus, masturbating to certain kinds of deviant fantasy or imagery runs the risk in young men of leading them eventually into actually doing that behavior. This has been repeatedly documented in both psychoanalytic literature as well as behavioral psychology, including Albert Bandura's classic book on behavioral psychology. I find that most sexual deviations that I see and treat are highly addictive. Once you get locked into that, they're highly addictive and extremely difficult to treat or change. Thus, in my judgment, the church is not especially off base by suggesting some cautions about masturbatory activities. I think that many sex educators are promoting a myth when they suggest that there are absolutely no negative consequences with masturbation, which is no less damaging than the myth of old that suggested that young men might become insane or lose their virility if he masturbated regularly. In other words, I'm suggesting there are two kinds of myths, both of which are foolishness and are just not true. I would suggest reading Donald Karn's book, The Sexual Addiction, for further enlightenment on this issue, or read Stanley Rockman's series of research papers on conditioning young men into sexual deviation in the laboratory, which he has done repeatedly. This was done in England. We could never do it in the U.S. with all the protections for human subjects, but he actually conditioned men very easily into sexual deviancy using traditional learning paradigms. Now, when the manual suggests that there is no sex drive, only a learned appetite, I find that confusing, frankly. And I agree with Mr. Day's concern. Maybe in the manual it's just a matter of semantics or calling the sex drive by a different name. I don't understand that. I would conclude by quoting one of Mr. Day's statements. He said, "But whatever the shortcomings of the manual, there is much to applaud, and loudly at that, for the guide contains some of the most positive affirmations of the holiness of human sexuality that has been publicly made by the church. The manual puts the church squarely on record for the first time as officially endorsing non-procreational aspects of human sexuality. It would be difficult to exaggerate the importance of this pronouncement for the development of healthy attitudes about marital sex." Thank you.
We have about 15 or 20 minutes now for questions. Yes.
Thank you. Since that was produced by a number of people, I do not think it would be appropriate for me to disseminate that. And I'll be very frank with you. It was really truly a rough draft and nothing more than that. It was our first crack at it. And I was really not very happy with it either. And I appreciate what you're saying, but I do not think it would be appropriate for me to, and I wouldn't want to anyway, because I just don't think it was in good enough shape, in a sense, to be, because it was a combination of the work of many, many people, and it was put together, the initial draft, in slapdash fashion, to be really very honest with you, and with different styles and things that we didn't all agree with or whatever. But that's the sense I would have about that. Thank you.
Other questions? Yes.
Okay, celibacy among single LDS people, you know, that is a very sensitive, and it's, and with many LDS people that I see or work with in counseling or whatever, who have a very healthy warm, positive sexual drive. This is a really very, very difficult thing for them to deal with or handle. And yet the church is very clear in its position about this, and that is it is opposed to promiscuous or even sexual activity outside the marriage bond or unity. And, you know, I don't have an answer to that. And I empathize and I feel pain for these people. And each person has to solve that problem the best they can. But it's very clear how the church stands on that. And, you know, I don't see a solution that's easily to come by. And that's all I can say about that.
Mr. Dave, do you want to comment on that? Or?
I wonder if that isn't an area somewhat similar to what the teenagers face, where perhaps masturbation would be an acceptable outlet. I wondered, as Dr. Klein was talking about the involvement of masturbation in the development of deviancy, whether that's really an association of masturbation or whether that's an association of the type of fantasy that the masturbator is using. And I'm not sure that is evidence that all masturbation is dangerous or bad. But I'm familiar with that. You know, I've read some of that research, and then there seems to be very strong evidence that deviant type of fantasies do become extremely strongly enforced.
Other questions? Yes. This gentleman here. Let's take the one in front and then behind next. Who wants to begin?
Oh, okay, I'll be very frank with you. I felt very uncomfortable with that. And the reason I felt uncomfortable is that when the ecclesiastical leader got too deep into the couple's personal lives, then this ran the risk of being a turn-on for him. And I think... and I hope... I'm saying that, I hope, in a friendly way, but I'm just saying is that there were some risks there. And I think that the couples do have a right to privacy. Now, if somebody's been involved in sexual activity that could lead to serious problems or which is totally out of line maybe with church standards, I think certainly this could be dealt with. But I think that on every couple in the ward that has a temple recommend, I just felt uncomfortable with it. And that's all I can share with you, how I felt.
Mr. Day, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, thank you. I likewise felt very uncomfortable about it, and I guess I take what I don't know whether to define this as a liberal or a conservative position, but it just seems to me that sexuality in marriage is a matter for the couple and the Lord, and I guess I'm always a little surprised and disappointed at the number of people who want a bishop or the president of the church or someone to tell them what they can do. They don't want to take that responsibility on themselves. I guess it's my personal philosophy that whatever a couple does in that sexual relationship in marriage that is not harmful to either one, and which is done with the full consent of both of them, is nobody else's business. Obviously, if they have some problems in expressing their sexuality, then it's my conviction they should resort to a qualified counselor to work on those problems. But other than that, it's between them.
With the gentleman back here with next. And then
That's an extremely interesting observation, and there may be certainly some element of truth in it. I have to think about that one a little bit, but I really appreciate that thought and comment.
Our time is up, so if you'll join me with in giving a hand to these gentlemen, we appreciate the contribution.
This is the end of this cassette.